You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme...
I think there's a sense of nostalgia for a stable Tunisia, for a Tunisia that did well. And you have to remember, the public sector here is huge, so I wouldn't be surprised if Media Tour has actually garnered a lot of support among public sector workers.
From elections in Tunisia and the media in Egypt to a troop handover in Afghanistan, we'll review the day's top stories with Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House and Daniela Pellad from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Then we're in Canada to talk politics and scandal with our man in Toronto. We'll also meet the man behind the first English translation of the famous 1988 novel from Egyptian writer Sanaa Ibrahim, Beirut, Beirut. All that, plus a bit of art in Italy and some music too. That's coming up on Midori House, starting right now. So, as ever, huge amounts to pack into the next 60 minutes. And first, here's Paul Osborne with the world news headlines.
Ukraine's president and prime minister are to publish a draft coalition agreement after preliminary results of Sunday's election showed their parties neck and neck. Petro Poroshenko and Arseniy Yatsenyuk say other parties will join talks on a new government. Election monitors say the poll was free and fair, and though there was no voting in eastern areas held by pro-Russian separatists. Mr. Poroshenko says it is a significant moment for Ukraine.
I think that this election was another test. Ukraine successfully passed for the democracy, for the openness, for the freedom. And I will kindly ask you to maybe accelerate the process of ratification, the association agreement in your countries.
Tunisia's main Islamist party has accepted defeat in the country's elections. Ennahda had formally congratulated its secular rival, Nidat Tunis, which won the most seats in the country's parliament. The elections came 4 years after the uprising that led to the wider Arab Spring. The talks on a coalition government could be several weeks away. Kenneth Woolock, an election observer in Tunisia, says the country's progress towards democracy is going well.
You had an electoral framework that put a great emphasis on inclusion of women, inclusion of young people, and a system that, in a sense, favors, in terms of representation, small political parties and independent candidates.
Egypt's president has ordered the military to protect state facilities, including power plants and gas pipelines. It follows an attack by militants last week in which more than 30 soldiers were killed. The president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, declared a 3-month state of emergency after that attack in Sinai. But critics say it is another crackdown on dissent. It means civilians could be tried by military courts, possibly for joining street protests. A nurse quarantined in New Jersey after treating Ebola patients in Sierra Leone is to be allowed to go home. Casey Hickox had threatened legal action, saying she was being treated like a criminal. After 24 hours without showing any symptoms of Ebola, officials now say she can return to her home state of Maine. The governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie.
The plan from my perspective is if the medical folks there want to let her go, we have a safe way to transport her from New Jersey to Maine, then I'd be more than happy to have her go home because that's where she'll be most comfortable.
Meanwhile, the head of the UN's Ebola response mission says decisions on quarantine should be based on science and not hysteria. Anthony Banbury says there's a risk that health workers will refuse to travel to West Africa, where there have now been more than 10,000 cases of the disease. At least 27 members of a Shia militia in Iraq have been killed in a suicide bomb attack, hours after the last Islamic State militants were forced from a key town near the capital. Jouf al-Saqqa could have been used as a staging post on any militant attack on Baghdad. The Shia fighters had helped Iraqi government forces to push out the militants there. The last British and US forces have left a key base in southern Afghanistan. At its height, Camp Bastion was the size and population of a small city. The complete handover to Afghan security forces is a significant stage in the drawdown of foreign combat troops, 13 years after the start of the mission to depose the Taliban in Afghanistan. A small international force will remain to train and mentor Afghan troops. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul Osborne, thank you very much indeed. 1805 here in London, 1405 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London to Hong Kong,
to Singapore,
to Zurich,
to Tokyo,
to Frankfurt,
to Istanbul,
to Sao Paulo,
to Santiago.
Broadcasting around the world, around the clock.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guests today are Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and Daniela Peled, an editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Jane and Daniela, welcome to you both. We're going to begin in Tunisia. Historic elections took place yesterday, marking a transition in the country from dictatorship to democracy. Before we get into it here, let's hear from our Tunisian correspondent Navina Kator and what she had to say a little earlier.
There are some people here who are aware of the attention and who are very much aware of the role the country has been asked to play in the Arab world and in the region. I have to say, I do think most Tunisians have other problems than think about kind of what role they can play. Those Tunisians who are aware of it were sending kind of messages of encouragement and hope to people in Libya, to people in Egypt, about the prospect of democracy there and a sense of encouragement. There's a lot of international attention here. I was actually talking to a German, he wasn't an observer, he's based here and he's working for a German foundation here. And he was actually, interestingly, referring as Tunisia as a country that Europe shares a border with. He was comparing the transition here to what happened in Eastern Europe 20 years ago. And he was saying the Europeans should think very hard about giving Tunisia, not just economic assistance, but the prospect of actually economically integrating into the European Union and opening up the market. So I think they're very interesting ideas being bandied around here at the moment.
Navina Kator there in Tunis. Jane Kinnamont, this is, you know, who knows what's going to happen next, but right now this is something to celebrate, isn't it?
That's right. It seems that the elections, like the previous elections in Tunisia, have passed pretty smoothly, have been well run. There will be a surprise for Ennahda because they thought they were going to win. But the outcome is going to be another coalition government, which will require secularists and Islamists to work together. So far, they've been quite successful in reaching compromises over the constitution and so forth, certainly compared to the news from almost all of the rest of the Middle East. This is a more positive one to watch.
Daniela Peled, it's very easy to sit here and look at Tunisia and say, well, look, there we are. There's the model. Come on, Egypt. Come on, Libya. What's your problem? It's obviously more complicated than that. But even within North Africa, there is a sense that, well, hang on. Yeah, Tunisia has shown us a way forward. Tunisia is a model that maybe we should be looking to try to emulate.
Certainly. I mean, I don't think people think this, there's going to be some very linear narrative from the start of the Arab uprisings in 2011, which are going to magically transform step by step into, you know, we're going to reach the goal of secular liberal democracy. I think it's really not as simple as that. But this does cheer me, not least because it gives the light of that very right-wing narrative that the Middle East can only see religious violence and extremism and get rid of the dictator and after that, you know, the deluge, the Muslim Brotherhood. And actually what it's shown is the citizens of Tunisia seeing, well, the government isn't delivering and they'd like another government. Thank you very much. The thing is, though, as you said, Tunisia is a unique example. Ennahda has always been much more moderate, much more willing to compromise than branches of the Muslim Brotherhood elsewhere.
And also the country's economy was in a far stronger state before the end of the dictatorship.
Yeah, so that's the circumstances in each country are different, but I think it's quite useful, really, for people who have a more want to have a more progressive view on where the region is going to be able to point to examples and say, sorry, it's not all about tribalism and it's not all about Islam.
Jane Kinnamont, this has been, Danielle mentions linear narratives. You know, the very simple narrative of this is that the Islamists have been beaten and a secular party has been elected. Again, in a country where the majority of people are Muslim, it's not quite as straightforward as that, is it?
Absolutely. I mean, based on the preliminary results, you're looking at Nida Tunis having about 15% more seats than in Ennahda. So it is a clear victory, but it's not a crushing defeat for Ennahda. And the point is that they are going to have to work together. They're going to have to reach some compromises that satisfy both their constituencies. Also worrying to both those parties is the jihadi factor in Tunisia. It may be quite a tiny minority of the population in percentage terms, but Tunisia has been one of the biggest source countries for foreign fighters going to the Islamic State and also into Libya. So that's something that is going to prey on the minds of Tunisians and lead to a lot of ongoing security concerns.
I want to come on to that issue in a bit more detail in a moment. But first, Jane, on the issue of there being a coalition government and how they're going to work together, this won't be the first coalition government in Tunisia. The first government after the initial elections after 2011, when Ben Ali was thrown out, also led to a coalition government. And do you think that Tunisian politics is well geared up towards coalitions at the moment?
I think you've seen a willingness to compromise from the different parties involved. I think Ennahda are actually very critical of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. They think they made quite a lot of mistakes, for instance, in running a candidate for the presidency and taking on such a leading role during the transition. So I think that willingness to compromise is still there, and that there's also a fairly broad consensus about the nature of economic policy. Which is a good thing, because the government's going to have to work very hard to attract more investment into Tunisia. They may be a middle-income country, but they do have a poverty problem that many people think is linked to the radicalisation problem. They desperately need to build on the election to attract more investment.
I think also, Steve, you make it a good point about highlighting the division between secular government and religious government. Because when we say secular government in this, it doesn't automatically mean magical liberal democracy, respect for human
Absolutely.
Rights and the law. Secular government can and will is most likely to be still quite conservative culturally and socially conservative. And that's, I think that's important to bear in mind. But I'm also cheered by the coalition prospects. I think it says a lot about the growing political maturity of a country when you don't have a black and white win, a massive defeat for one side, a victory for the other side, when people have to work together and build coalitions. I think that's an encouraging sign. It's encouraging as how political parties work in opposition. I think that says a lot about the political culture of a country, more than, you know, sweeping coups, victories, dictatorship.
you mentioned coups and dictatorships. Let's talk about Egypt and how, if you're a liberal in Egypt, you're in Tahrir Square, you were one of those that thought that Mubarak has gone, we're going to herald in a new form of democracy here. Mm. And then obviously it hasn't happened. I think is sort of the easiest way of saying that. Daniela, what lessons would you be trying to learn from Tunisia if you were that Egyptian liberal who'd been in Tahrir Square for those 18 days?
Wow, that's very difficult. I'm not really in the position to teach anybody lessons about that. But I think one of the worrying signs that's coming out of Egypt is the state of the media and the state of freedom of speech. And what's really worrying is it's not that the government has had to lift a finger, really, but the media, the mainstream media have thrown themselves with delight into self-censorship. And now it's being seen as increasingly un-Egyptian, unpatriotic to criticise national institutions. Ironically or paradoxically, during the time when Morsi was president, there was a bit of an upsurge of satire and political criticism. Now, yeah, it's disappeared from the mainstream press. Although at the same time, the online sphere was always where this kind of debate and discussion went on. But I think that's very sad, because that doesn't reach a mass audience by any stretch of the imagination.
Jane, it's become a real problem recently in Egypt, hasn't it? That you've got this issue now of essentially self-censorship of newspaper editors trying to prove their loyalty to Sisi, to the state, by going over the top. There was one columnist today saying that Sisi should put aside his morals and act like a fascist over what's happening in Sinai. There's the tone of the debate has become somewhat obsequious and also slightly worrying.
Absolutely. I think you've seen a very strong xenophobic current as well. There's been a lot of anti-American conspiracy theories. While there's obviously plenty of reasons to criticise America, there have been quite extreme conspiracy theories about how the US was behind the Muslim Brotherhood.
They were good friends with the Muslim Brotherhood, yes, because it fits in well with US ideology.
And plotting to split off Sinai into an Islamic state at the behest of Mossad and all sorts of, I mean, very imaginative conspiracy theories. But things that are worrying, especially when you're whipping up that kind of anti-Western sentiment in a country that crucially depends on tourism, much of which comes from the West. I think there's some of that self-censorship has always been there. I remember an amazing long radio interview that I did with Egyptian State English Language Radio, which nobody listens to.
I'm going to be tuning in after this.
But after the revolution, and me and some colleagues had, bizarrely, we were in Cairo and we'd been invited on this show, and it was two presenters, and one of them was reveling in the newfound freedom and asking lots of things about Chatham House's political work, and the other person couldn't cope with any of this and would change the subject all the time and ask things like, but in love, do you think one should always take a risk? And then she would play Barry Manilow. And it was really bizarre.
I'm definitely tuning into this radio station. They're doing Barry Manilow
and
politics.
Everyone is missing out, you know. But there was that kind of experimentation at the time. I think now there has been a kind of lesson learned from things like the Al Jazeera trial, that if even kind of foreign international correspondents are not immune, then the risk of imprisonment and repression could happen to almost anyone. And excuse me going on about this, but there was a great article I've just read by Nathan Brown, the academic, who characterises pre-revolution Egypt as not so much a situation of repression by the regime, but depression with the regime. That the way that the Mubarak regime operated was by making everyone feel, well, we don't much like this regime, but there's nothing else. Mm. And I think in a way that's what they're going back to.
And Daniela, in terms of pressures that can be put on Egypt from outside, there's obviously aid from the West, and the US has occasionally sort of made noises about, well, we might cut off this military aid, but has pretty...
Not very enthusiastic, brief noises.
And has then decided to write a cheque. Yeah. On tourism, you had the CEO of Thomas Cook recently here in this country talk about how she was going to nip over to Egypt to bend Sisi's ear about, you know, letting more people in, as if, good luck to her. But there seems to be very little that certainly the West can do right now, or seems to be willing to do right now.
Right. I mean, apart from the usual NGO cliches of, you know, capacity building and small steps and empowering citizens. I mean, the fact is that, you know, it was a coup that unseated Morsi, but it was quite a popular coup. I'm not entirely sure that had there been slightly more candidates running against Sisi, that he might not have won anyway. But obviously democracy is far more than, you know, one person and one vote. I find the freedom of speech issue is particularly troubling, because without that, you really can't have any kind of emerging democracy. And it's institutions themselves that are not being held to account that suffer, whether it's local government, whether it's the police service, and whether it's national government. Because it's not just Sisi at the head who is inviolable, which perhaps was the case in Mubarak, where you could criticise other aspects of government, but not... not Mubarak. But here it's a general sort of creeping idea of insulting the state of Egypt and the institutions, and anybody who's not with us is against us.
Jenna, we'll go back to Tunisia and the role that Tunisia can play within the region, not just as being held up as a model, but are there, do you think, the possibility of Tunisian politicians and leaders deciding to play more of a regional role and having some harsh words for their friends in, be they in Libya or Egypt?
I think they do have an important story to tell other Islamist groups in the region who have probably overreached themselves more. Unfortunately, I think the Muslim Brotherhood hasn't had enough introspection and self-criticism about the reasons why it became unpopular and why there was so much popular support for that coup, as Daniela mentioned, because they have been the victims of repression and very serious human rights abuses. Hundreds of people killed
in
the streets.
Quite hard for them all to get together to have a meeting to discuss what went wrong.
They're probably all visiting London. I mean, this has become a real centre for Muslim Brotherhood opposition in exile. There's a much delayed UK government study about the Muslim Brotherhood overdue to come out soon, but it's still a place.
Is this the one where we're going to say, actually, they're not terrorists after all?
Exactly. I mean, it's still a place that I think Europe and sometimes America are still venues where these people can have discussions actually more freely than in most parts of the region, possibly even Qatar now.
Indeed. On that issue, though, of the voices that might come from North Africa, is this, am I sort of holding out too much hope on this, Daniela? Because it is one thing for us to sit around and say, well, this is very bad and something should be done. But the idea, frankly, of any Egyptian military leader listening to any of us is pretty slim. But a popularly elected Tunisian politician who's shown that there is another way, that could be a bit different.
But still, Egypt, I mean, I don't want to, be so negative, but Egypt is bigger, stronger, more powerful, more important regionally than Tunisia. Tunisia is really small. Mm. It has, 11 million people? It's teeny, really. And it may be, I mean, I truly hope it's a regional success story, but in terms of it extending its diplomatic clout in the region, I think it would be a bit premature to hope that's what would happen.
Okay. Daniela Pellet, Jane Kinnamont, thank you both for now. In a moment, we'll be talking about Afghanistan. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and into the Americas.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still here with me, Jane Kinnamont of Chatham House and Daniela Pellet of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. As you heard a little earlier in the news today, after 13 years of military operations and the loss of 453 British troops, the UK's combat mission in Afghanistan has ended. Daniela Pellet, you've been to Afghanistan quite a lot over the last few years. If you look back at what happened since the Western intervention at the end of 2001 following September the 11th, is the country in a better state than it was then?
Wow. Well, that's very, very, very hard to say. If you look at the number and access of women to education, for instance, that's higher, much higher. If you look at infrastructure built, well, that's much greater. If you look at the number of aforementioned NGOs busy at work in Afghanistan, that's also very high.
If you use number of NGOs as any sort of meter of whether a country's doing well.
But the thing is, that's not the reason why there was an intervention in Afghanistan. And if you think the original purpose was to sever the link between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and stop it being, a haven. Well, that was done in 5 minutes.
Yes.
It was done by the end of 2001. If the parameters are different, if it was about destroying the Taliban, that hasn't happened at all. If it was about stopping opium and heroin production, that hasn't happened at all either.
It's now at record levels.
Quite. And it's not, you can't have a military solution to political and domestic and regional issues. You can have a military solution to a military problem, like unseating Al-Qaeda, but the long span of 13 years, well, I think looking at whether Afghanistan is now a better place than it was 13 years ago, you would really have to ask quite a lot of Afghans that.
Jane Kinnamon, if you look at all the different reasons given for why the West had troops in Afghanistan, we'd be here all night. Because as Danielle says, originally, this was about, you know, the Taliban were sheltering Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. They were told, if you don't give them up, we'll remove you from power. They didn't give them up, so we came in to remove them from power. But by December 2011, they were gone. Then why were we still there?
There was obviously a fairly quick move to turn what was supposed to be a war on terrorism into a war against states, because it's something that the US military was more able to do than to fight insurgent movements. But I think there are also arguments. I mean, without necessarily endorsing the interventions in the first place, I can see the arguments why once you have removed a government, you might stay around to try to rebuild the state. And Libya is probably the best counter example of that, where it wasn't officially a regime change, but the regime change wouldn't have happened without the no-fly zone. And now, ironically, you get quite a lot of Libyans saying, why wasn't the West around for longer to try to demilitarise all these militias and get more involved in the state building? So there are reasons that they stayed to try to prevent the Taliban from coming back. But, you know, it's not very clear how much of those objectives have been met. And I suspect your average voter in the UK or US wouldn't be able to tell you much about why we've been there for so long or what we've got out of it.
Because it did seem to keep on changing, Danielle, didn't it? It was, you know, Gordon Brown would very simplistically put it as, we're fighting them there so they don't bring the fight to the streets of the UK.
Sounds very familiar, doesn't it? Have we heard that before?
You heard similar things from George W. Bush. You had the fight against the opium trade, and because heroin was going to flood the streets of the UK and the US and something must be done about it. And yet, as Jane mentions there, you know, Libya is the opposite argument that, well, we went in there, got rid of Gaddafi, and then scarpered.
Totally. I mean, look, this isn't the end of Western military involvement in Afghanistan. The new president, Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzai, has signed an agreement with the Americans. So about 10,000 American troops will stay, and number gradually reduced for the next 2 years. And this is actually pretty popular, and this is actually quite a good idea, I think. For all the talk of occupation, military occupation, the Afghan army, the Afghan National Army, has done quite a good job of being reformed and reforming itself. Numbers are up. I mean, the police reforms have lagged somewhat behind. But, you know, the security services did a fairly thorough job of securing the elections this summer. I mean, two rounds of elections could have gone horribly wrong. There were fairly limited amount of violence. And so there will be a military presence to carry on in an advisory role. And I think few people would argue against that. And hopefully it will stop the repeat of what we saw in Iraq, where the US were very keen to leave, and so were the Iraqis. And then ISIS turned up and the Iraqi army ran away. I mean, this is a very simplistic reading of it, but, you know, I think Jane is very right. You need to be consistent. You can't just turn up, take military action and leave. And all the development work also needs a security aspect. There's no point having a girls' school if people are too frightened to walk along the road, the newly built road, to get to it.
Jane, what do you think this does to Western countries, the UK and US in particular, in terms of their publics, whether they are willing to consider military action again in the near future, and whether politicians feel like they are willing to make the case to their publics?
Well, you've seen this intervention in Iraq, you know, even if it's limited, which I think a year or so ago, most people would have predicted that the British public was not prepared to do that. We saw the vote over, you know, the possibility of airstrikes against the Assad regime, and generally MPs said people are against more military intervention. But you saw the spectre of the Islamic State really playing out in the media and dramatically changing public opinion. So it does show you that public opinion can be quite flexible.
Yes, although it was sort of a very anguished debate, which led to the UK agreeing to send 6 planes.
It has been, but I think, you know, if you look at the pressure on Barack Obama, who was elected on a mandate of withdrawal, you then saw that really turn around to him being pushed by rivals saying, you're not intervening enough in the Middle East. Aren't you going to do something and fix it?
Danielle, just finally, listening to all the politicians who've been involved in it, it's, you know, the number of defence secretaries the UK's had since 2001 when this first began is in itself tells a story. Very few are willing to stand up and say, yes, this was a big success. We're proud of what we've done.
Because you have more than 400 military casualties. And don't forget that Britain has a long history with Afghanistan. Mm. There were, you know, 100 or more years ago, there were soldiers coming back wounded from a similar war. And it's I think it's got a place in the popular imagination, you know, are the boys Afghanistan needing to leave? I don't think it was I don't think it was presented in a context of nation building so much. It's about defeating a military objective. And we've seen that really hasn't happened. And I think, but it also comes into that whole very British thing of not being terribly triumphalist. I don't think I can imagine a withdrawal now and people saying, right, we've brought freedom to the people of Afghanistan and our boys didn't die in vain. That's just not British style.
I don't know. Falklands War, the floaters, the crowds.
Exactly. Thatcher. I think I can't imagine scenes like that now. I think people were, you know, at the time, very soon after, I think people were pretty disillusioned.
Daniela Pellad from the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House, thank you both very much. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London
to Hong Kong to Singapore
to Zurich
to Tokyo
to Toronto
to Istanbul.
Broadcasting around the world, around the clock.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. 18:31 here in London, 14:31 in Rio. We'll be there in a moment, but first, here's Paul Osborne with the World News headlines.
The President and Prime Minister of Ukraine say they will publish a draft coalition agreement after preliminary results of Sunday's election showed their parties neck and neck in Parliament. Petro Poroshenko and Arseniy Yatsenyuk say other parties will join talks on a new government. Election monitors say the poll was free and fair, though there was no voting in the eastern areas held by pro-Russian separatists. The president of Egypt has ordered the military to step in to protect facilities, including power plants and gas pipelines. It follows an attack by militants last week in which more than 30 soldiers were killed. But critics say it means civilians could be tried by military courts in a further crackdown on dissent. A nurse who'd been quarantined in New Jersey after treating Ebola patients in Sierra Leone is to be allowed to go home. Casey Hickox had threatened legal action and said she was being treated like a criminal. But after 24 hours without showing any symptoms of Ebola, she's to be allowed to return to her home state of Maine. And the last, British and US forces have left a key base in southern Afghanistan. The complete handover of Camp Bastion to Afghan security forces is a significant step in the drawdown of foreign combat troops 13 years after the start of the mission to depose the Taliban. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Let's head now to Toronto, where our Toronto correspondent Chris Frey is standing by. And Chris, I believe it's a very sad day for all people in Toronto. Well, it's a very sad day for all of us around the world because it's the last day that we can enjoy the mayoralty of Rob Ford.
Yes. Well, and I think at some time Andrew Mueller used to refer to me as the Rob Ford correspondent for Monocle. So
no longer.
I will have to give up that precious title as well. Although Rob Ford is running for his old council seat. And as you probably know as well, his brother Doug Ford is trying to take his place as mayor. Although it's a pretty
long. Are you
going to
be the
stretch.
Doug Ford correspondent? Or is that unlikely, do we think?
I think it's unlikely. Doug is too far behind in the polls. I mean, recent history, polls have been pretty off in a few big elections. But I can't see him pulling this one out. He has his natural constituency. He's sort of topped out around that 20-25%. But Doug Ford is not the kind of guy who is going to win more voters over. Literally everything that was up for grabs was between John Tory, who is the front runner at this point, probably has about a 14-point in the most recent poll over Doug, and Olivia Chow, who started this campaign many months ago in the lead, but did not run a very great campaign. It's only in the last few weeks, I think, that people have started to turn back to her. The big question was over strategic voting, was how do we make sure a Ford does not get elected? Were you going to vote for Tory or Olivia Chow? Now, Tory is more traditionally a conservative, Chow left-leaning, and I think a lot of traditional Chow supporters have looked at Tory as the opportunity to get Ford from office. So that's been the real story in the last week. There haven't been any major gaffes from the Ford camp, so the issue has sort of become strategic voting and what's its value and, you know,
and with it becoming, you know, a race that seems to be pretty much between Doug Ford and John Tory, you know, a few people have pointed out that is this really a representation of Toronto, you know, a liberal city that's not as white as it was, and yet here we are with two old white men battling out to be mayor.
Well, for what it's worth, Olivia Chow, Chinese-Canadian immigrant, is probably running neck and neck with Doug Ford, and it was at one point the leader in this. And, some have said it was hers to lose at the outset, and she simply did not run a great campaign. I read that story, I think, making that argument this morning in The Guardian, Toronto being the cosmopolitan, multicultural city that it is. And just to make things a little more complicated, Rob Ford, his constituency, much of it was in, like, visible minority communities, the black community, for example, about whom he said some vile, reprehensible things, still a large segment of that community will vote for him.
Just briefly, before we go on to the other main story we're going to talk about today, the shooting in Ottawa last week, there's obviously been a lot of analysis reporting over the weekend. What are the big things that we should know about the latest?
Well, what we're learning is that this may have been less about religion and ideology than simply mental illness. And it's not just the shooting that occurred on Wednesday, but of course, 2 days earlier, there was that sort of hit and run attack. The driver who tried to hit two Canadian soldiers and actually killed one of them, who similarly was self-radicalized, who was similarly born in Canada and didn't necessarily have those natural connections to Islam. So I think what we're learning is, though, the Harper government clearly is using both events as a pretext to fast track some further security measures. The spy agency has been asking for expanded powers of surveillance and tracking and apprehension. But I think, rightly, opponents now are seeing this more for what it is, that if we're going to talk about prevention, it may be less about securitization and more about collaboration with Muslim communities and imams. And for example, if they notice an overzealous convert in their midst, are there things that they can do to intercede and, you know, prevent something like this from happening, rather than just, ramping up the security measures, which in many cases have not worked?
Okay. And then finally, Jean Ghomeshi, who most Canadians will know who he is, but and some Americans as well. But for the rest of us, first of all, fill us in with who he is, and then let's talk very carefully about what he may or may not have done.
Well, he is one of the marquee names of the national broadcaster, the CBC, principally on radio, but now you're increasingly seeing him on television. He is a national celebrity. He also hosts many high-profile public events. He hosts a popular culture and current events program every morning called Q. And interestingly, so first what happened was Friday, it was announced he'd be going on leave for an undetermined amount of time. People had known that his father died a few weeks ago. But then yesterday, especially within the media world, you'd imagine in Toronto, the story went nuclear when first it was revealed that CBC had actually fired Ghomeshi. And then Ghomeshi himself took to social media, not just to defend himself, but really to launch a counterattack. In his Facebook message, which was about 1,500 words, he claimed he's the victim of a smear campaign, admitting that while he does engage in BDSM and other what he calls adventurous sexual activities, the sex he's had has always been consensual. The Toronto Star yesterday afternoon published a report in which three women say that they engaged in what they called unconsexual violent sex, and another spoke of workplace harassment. The CBC has mostly been mum on the reasons, the precise reasons for why they're dismissing him. But Gomeshi has hired Navigator, which is the country's most high-profile PR firm, one that specializes in celebrities or officials in distress. And he's suing the CBC for $50 million for breach of confidence and bad faith.
And as things stand at the moment, obviously it's... a lot of this is news to a lot of people in Canada that this is going on. But what happens next? Because obviously, he's not working for CBC anymore. Is there going to be any sort of police inquiry? Has there been anything like that? Does the Toronto Star, do we think, have more stuff that they're going to print?
Well, I think I can say this, that there have been rumors, not very flattering to Gomeshi, for years about his dating behavior that have circulated within the Toronto media community. There is a local podcast and podcast producer and journalist named Jesse Brown who had been working and investigating this story. I think to get more resources, he collaborated with the Toronto Star and Kevin Donovan, who famously also worked on the Rob Ford story. Right now they have the three women who have been talking. The police have said that they have refused to comment on whether or not they're investigating any of this. But one can expect this to be radioactive for quite some time. People have obviously distanced themselves from Gomeshi and also actually quite fearful right now to actually say anything or speak out because of this, this $50 million lawsuit he already claims he's going to, bring to against the CBC.
Chris Frey in Monocle's Toronto Bureau. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Up next, we'll meet the translator of Egyptian novelist Sanaa Ibrahim's famous novel, Beirut, Beirut.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because dragstar taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show.
I look at it and I think, God, could I really live like that? Could it really be me? But I know that it was, so I do connect with it.
Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. 1943 in London, 1843, sorry, in Rome rather, 1843 here in London, 11:43 a.m. in San Francisco. Sanaa Ibrahim is one of Egypt's most famous writers. He was described in a recent profile by The New Yorker as Egypt's oracular novelist. And now one of his novels has been introduced in English for the first time. Beirut, Beirut, published in Arabic in 1988, is set during the Lebanese Civil War. The plot follows an Egyptian writer who's travelled to Beirut in search of a publisher. US-based translator Chip Rossetti is responsible for bringing Ibrahim's words to life in English in a new edition published by Bloomsbury. And Chip joins us now from Monocle's New York Bureau. Chip Rossetti, thank you very much for joining us today. Why do you think it's taken so long, almost a generation, for Beirut to be translated into English?
That's a good question. Well, for a lot of Arabic novels, there's often a gap between when they are published in the original and when they get sort of rediscovered in English. And in this case, it's a little surprising, simply because Sonala Ibrahim is such a well-respected and prominent Egyptian novelist. But these things happen, and I'm glad it's come out, finally.
And tell us about the process of working on it, because it's obviously when you're doing a book like this that everyone, you know, that knows about it, really knows about it well and has a great understanding of it. When it comes to doing the translation, it's quite a tricky thing to get right, particularly from a language like Arabic.
It is. And Arabic, of course, is notoriously difficult for translators. Among other things, it's because of the range of types of speech, the formal kind of written Arabic, and then the very informal colloquial dialects spoken across the Arabic world, which can differ from region to region and city to city even. So in this case, Sonala Ibrahim generally writes in the formal standard Arabic, which makes it somewhat easier. However, the real difficulty I found in translating this was his documentary style and subject, in that it's about the Lebanese Civil War. So much of what he was writing about often involved me. I needed to sort of confirm with outside sources, were spellings correct? A lot of these were prominent politicians he's referring to, or events that were covered at the time in the 1970s and 80s. What's also tricky is, of course, Lebanon, with its long sort of French presence there. You could find a name that would, you could transliterate it into English, or you could do the commonly accepted English spelling for it, or pick, I guess, the French spelling. And some politicians would go with a French spelling of their name, or a Lebanese public figure, and others you have to decide how just to spell them. So in this case, it was in many ways a rediscovery. And you mentioned a number of people know this novel very well, but in some cases, I think it had dropped off the radar. Mm. So it was quite a pleasure to be able to sort of re-find it and bring it out again.
And was Sonala Ibrahim willing to work with you on this project, or did he just sort of let you get on with it? And if you had any questions, he might answer them if he had time.
Well, he actually was very helpful in the process of translation. I can't tell you how useful it is to have a living writer that you're working with. So if you do get stuck on something, there really is. You can always
go back to the source. Yes,
that's true. As opposed to an 800-year-old text, there's really not much you can do. It's in that case, he was very helpful in sort of fielding questions and what did you mean by this, or this is a particularly obscure reference that perhaps I'm not catching. So there are always things like that you come across, and it is a real blessing to have a writer who is willing to answer those up front. And of course, he reads English and has taught in the United States, and I believe at one point to the entire manuscript, sort of he saw the entire thing from the publisher.
How important do you think it is for Egyptian novels from this era to get a broader audience in English? Do you think, particularly given everything else that's happening in the Arab world at the moment, that there is sort of more of an urgency about some of the best writing from that region reaching an English-speaking audience?
Well, I would say there's always an urgency to have world literature reach us in English. That's sort of an ongoing issue. For Arabic in particular, it's often you start to think about how American and sort of British publishers, English language publishers, treat Arabic literature. Is it often it's treated as sort of a sociological kind of exercise, that we need to read these in order to figure out our policy towards the Arab world, or what's happening after 9/11, which is what naturally a lot of people hope to do to get out of literature. But of course, there are things that go on under the radar when they're not necessarily tied to a particular urgency to what's going on in the world. But of course, the more literature, the more you read about what people are writing in other parts of the world, the better informed you are about what drives them, what their fears are, their ambitions, that kind of thing, and what has shaped their world. And what surprised me most about Beirut is how much, when it came out, he was really writing for an Egyptian audience, basically essentially taking them through what was going on next door in Lebanon, or nearby in Lebanon, for the Civil War. What were the causes for it? What were the what prompted it? What were the issues at stake? And as someone like Ibrahim, as sort of a longtime secular leftist, this was a catastrophe that he was seeing unfold. And it really, he sort of brings that out, what was this prolonged 15-year civil war. Of course, when he wrote it, it was still going on, and the events of the novel are set in 1980, so it was still near the beginning of the civil war.
I'm afraid, sorry, we're going to have to end it there because we're running out of time. But Chip Rossetti, translator of Beirut by Sonala Ibrahim, thank you very much for joining us from our New York bureau. In a moment, a review of the latest and greatest art in Italy. First, though, with Losing You, it's Solange. Losing You by Solange, always good. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, time for our daily arts review. Today we're heading to Italy, where we're joined by Luca Mastrantonio, culture editor of Corriere della Sera. Luca, welcome to Midori House, and let's begin with an absolute classic, Van Gogh at the Palazzo Reale. Tell us all about it.
Yeah, hello. Van Gogh is The Man and the Hurt is an exhibition I suggest you have not to see, because it's really poor. It's incredibly poor, maybe not more than 50 works. And the topic is, we are going to the exhibition, the international exposition in Milan, and there's a little too much rhetoric about the food and the hurt and so the planet. This is a exhibition I think it's better not to see, but in the same place at Palazzo Reale, close to the dome, we can recall a very huge one. Maybe we spoke some months ago when it was to run, but it still runs until February of the next year. Is Marc Chagall, a very, very wonderful retrospective in Milan. So if you see Van Gogh and Chagall, don't have that, because it's only Van Gogh is a typical brand, namely brand exhibition. You put the name without the works. Indeed, the Marc Chagall retrospective at Palazzo Reale is really wonderful, with all the topic, the cycle with Bella, all the promenades, all the Jewish topics of Chagall. It's a very nice one.
Do you worry, Luca, that people go for the big name, the big headline, that art galleries plumb for them because they know that's going to bring in the visitors?
Yeah, you're talking about Van Gogh or
With the Van Gogh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that also it's typical. In Italy, we use a lot to put the name also with Dalí. In Rome, the first time I went 10 years ago, I saw two exhibitions about Dalí in different places, but in the same city. Sometimes we made this, I call fake exhibition. Also, Francesco Bonami, the Italian creator, made some hard critics about this exhibition on Van Gogh, because it's really poor, and I don't know what it was born, but of course can make people really, really sad to pay 12 euros. It's better to get a drink or going to the close exhibition of Chagall.
Okay, so the Chagall over the Van Gogh, but there's also the Joan Jonas exhibition at Hangar Bicocca, Light Time Tales. Tell us a bit more about this.
Yeah, this is a wonderful experience for me. I've never seen works of Joan Jonas. He's curated by Andrea Lissoni. It's the first anthological exhibition in Italy, and these artists will go to the Venice Biennale, but it's a sort of a nice appetizer about this great performer. And the place, it's also maybe one of the best in Italy, because the place Hangar Bicocca is really big. It was a factory in the last century where the hangars were Breda and other big companies built locomotive boilers, airplanes. And it's important also the artists explain why it's so important, a big place for this installation. We can remind the reanimation is a good one. It pulls together jazz and the lights, jokes with lights, and the installation and the works make a sort of dialogue in this big place without wall. And so is a creative and critic anthology of Joan Jones. That is, I mean, we don't have to remind her, maybe one of the great performer we have. So is in the heart of the contemporary art of Milan, the Hangar Bicocca. When I can, if we have just a few seconds.
Of course.
I don't know. Yeah. Because I want to speak about, because art, the place for me are really important, because you can see also a performance, but it's different. It's important with the place. And if you are going to Milan and you want to see something contemporary good, in the Hangar Bicocca, there's also the permanent installation of Ansel Keefer, the Seven Heavenly Palaces. And it's really nice because he used this, he's inspired by an ancient religion and represent the ancient book, the Book of Palaces. In the Hebrew language is Sefer Hechalot. But it's something ancient and something apocalyptic about the future, because it represents also the ruin maybe of the West culture after a world war. So okay. I suggest this place. Hangar Bicocca is in periphery, but it's nice to see this place, and also John Jonas.
Luca Mastrantonio, thank you very much indeed. So there you are. If you're in Milan, go to the Hangar Bicocca. Don't go to the Van Gogh. That was Luca Mastrantonio from Corriere della Sera, ending today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Jane Kinnamont and Daniela Peled. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by David Pleasant and Muriel Hawaji. The studio manager was Joel Church. Culture with Rob is up next after the headlines. Monocle Daily, 2200 hours London time. We're back same time tomorrow, 1800 hours in London, 1400 hours in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.